Okay, hello everyone, and as has become abundantly clear to us, there is a reason why people use introduction songs in podcasts, and it's because starting one out with a cold opening is really difficult.
Yeah, but, so that was a good job by you right there.
Thank you.
We are officially introduced.
Yes, this is our third podcast, and it comes on the week of Lookout Landing turning 5 years old, and the two-week anniversary of our first ever Lookout Landing podcast, obviously a much more significant anniversary.
2 weeks. I think that's silver.
Yeah. Where's my gift?
Well, looking over the first post on Lookout Landing history, it's interesting. You look at the other baseball blog section I highlighted on the sidebar when this post first went up. And here is the Sports Blog Nation baseball blogosphere when Lookout Landing joined.
It wasn't just baseball blogosphere. That was it. It wasn't any other sports.
Whoa,
right?
Okay. You're ruining the punchline here. Sorry. The Blog Roll, Athletics Nation, Maccabi Chronicles, Red Reporter. That was it. That was our blog roll. Lookout Landing was the fourth blog to join this network, and that I have nothing interesting to say about that. We now have 238 sites, including a horse racing site and a figure skating site.
I saw that, or at least I saw the link at the top of the Lookout Landing page, where, you know, more from SB Nation, something about figure skating, which, okay, sure. Whatever.
I guess it was timely, right?
There's fans. So
I just can't. I mean, is there anybody? I shouldn't. You know, I'm not going to belittle here because who knows who's listening to this podcast. So if you're the figure skating blogger for SB Nation, or even just for fun somewhere else, kudos to you. You have a niche role. You know,
I will say, looking over, because it's something that I did a week ago, just out of curiosity, looking over some of those posts from that first year. Obviously, we're dumber back then, but boy, was the tone a lot more hopeful.
Well, this was. Actually, yeah, this is after 2004.
Yeah, but even then, we'd had 2000 to 2003. 2004 was just a blip on the radar, man. We got Adrian Beltre, we got Richie Sexton, we're going to bounce right back. We got Joel Pinheiro coming back. Yeah.
You know, what's depressing, actually, is the fifth post in Lookout Landing history was about Bobby Madrich.
Yeah. Do you think if you knew now what you knew then, as far as what the next 5 years would be like? Like, how fast would you run away from blogging?
Well, considering I started blogging overall as a freshman in college, I probably could have been doing a lot more fun stuff otherwise. But hey, it's paid off now, right?
Sure. You have a podcast.
We have a podcast. We have a two-week-old podcast. Actually, I like going through the archives. First of all, while the writing was a lot worse and we were dumber, for example, I was all about Bobby Madrich because he didn't allow home runs. That's sustainable. One of the first posts, again, was calling out Ryan Franklin and that whole argument about how he was struggling because he didn't get run support. Yeah, you know, he was struggling because he sucked.
Yeah.
And I know there's revisionist people out there who are looking at Ryan Franklin being like, hey, he's a pretty good reliever now. Maybe he wasn't that bad when he was a Mariner. No, he was bad. He was terrible. And if you look him up on Fangraphs, I mean, I did my Noah Lowry rant last week, but maybe you should just copy all those words and move them over to this week about Ryan Franklin. He was bad.
And you can throw in a really shitty attitude, too, which makes it worse. You know? Nobody likes a complainer.
Yeah. You know, Ryan Franklin thought he had a rough one in 2014. Get in line, Ryan. God. I'm not going to just be on the air and recite numbers, but man, he had some bad numbers in Safeco.
Yeah, he didn't really miss bats ever, did he?
No, he was about one strikeout every two innings.
That's a weird ratio to put it in, but sure, okay.
Well, whatever. This sounds better than 4.5 per nine. It's not my fault Fangraphs doesn't list percentages. Yeah, and even if it did, people don't know average percentages off the top of their head.
I do.
Okay, but you're weird. Like, I would love it if sites were like, oh, he struck out 17% of the batters he faced. But the advantage of per nine is that people have a general idea of what's good and what's bad. But percentages, people aren't good with fractions and the like.
Yes, but you will notice that if you go to Stat Corner to look that up and you hover your mouse over title of the stat, you'll get a pop-up glossary which will contain the average.
Ian Snell, hovering over K percentage. Quote, the percentage of plate appearances resulting in a strikeout. There's no number there. You're a fucking liar.
Yeah, I think I might not have that yet. It's coming in 2000. Well, it's coming in version 2.
Sneak peek. Stat Corner, getting better.
Yes, it is getting better. It's getting some exciting stuff that's coming very soon. But anyways, cleaning up some, I guess, laundry from the last podcast.
No. I have one more thing to say because I just remember this. Sorry, we'll go to your thing in a minute. But the fourth post, up in Ellicott Landing was, you know, basically a bullet point post before bullet points were invented on the SB Nation platform. And I remember a lot of it. It was afternoon, and I was just sitting in my room in college, and I turned on ESPN2, and ESPN2 was showing competitive juggling. This is still when they weren't showing any hockey. They don't show any hockey now, of course. So I went on a blog, and I decided, I'm a blogger. I'm going to make fun of ESPN2 for showing competitive juggling, and I poked fun at some guy named Ivan Pessel. I don't know. I can't pronounce his name because he's a competitive juggler. Look at Lenny made it big because shortly after that post went up, I had to delete comments, inflammatory comments from one Ivan Pessel, who had found me, found my website, and decided to flame me for making fun of competitive juggling. The fact that Ivan Pessel, of course, Googled himself and found my website about 20 minutes after this post went up tells you a little bit about the world of competitive juggling, but I've not heard from him since.
I have never heard that story before.
I don't think I knew who you were back then, R.L. Jaws.
I don't know who that guy was. I will say that was not the low point of ESPN2, though. I think that came a year later when, swear to God, they had competitive cup stacking.
I saw Magic the Gathering, and they had that under the table, like the glass table camera that show you all the cards or something. It was wild.
Okay, that might be worse.
I got to close this archives because I just want to read all these old posts I put up.
It'll just make you feel bad.
There's like 7 posts about Jorge Campillo.
Yeah.
Okay, anyway.
It's worse when we went to Atlanta and got really good. But moving on. From cleaning up some stuff from the last podcast, and thanks to everyone who wrote in to let us know that there's absolutely no way that we can put any licensed music up on the podcast without exposing ourselves to a vast amount of liability, and since we make approximately $0.
There's a donation link.
There is a donation link, and... If you have any interest in, you know, helping us out with our introductions and not having such an awkward phase for us to get started in talking, that would be helpful. Or we'll just pick something from the public domain.
Yeah.
We could do a duet of the, A duet of the Battle Hymn of the Republic.
You know what's funny is we couldn't even play Happy Birthday for Look at Lanning.
No, of course you would say that because that's, I think, the first thing that comes to mind with anybody who knows that that song's not in the public domain.
Yeah, I know. That was the joke.
I know. I also thought of the joke.
Cool. Basically, your options, listeners, are we decided to put up some money for the song, or we have no song and it's super awkward, or we just sing our own song at the intro and make it weirder because we're not musicians.
Yeah.
So that's your choice. Maybe that's this week's poll. What do you want? And then we will ignore the poll, just as we're going to ignore last week's poll.
Right. Well, it didn't help that was a 50-50 split.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
Which further damaged whatever lingering faith I had in the voting process.
Democracy!
Woo!
Should have introduced a third party, I'm telling you.
Okay.
Dario Mata, or we personally call you and recite the podcast on the phone.
We could get a 1-900 number?
That's true.
That solves
it. Send your money to Happy DJ.
This is a good idea.
All right, we're going to phone spam your phone jihad.
Only $5.99 an hour. Next on the Lookout Landing podcast. Anyways, enough of that. Let's actually get to real topics that people
are interested in. All right,
baseball. Yeah, woo!
We're baseball fans. Baseball, Mariners.
Since the Senators aren't playing today.
Yeah.
So, Eric Burns.
Yeah. It's funny because it feels like we signed him weeks ago. Because every transaction, I swear to God, every little move this team makes, it doesn't drain me, you know, but I spend so much time thinking about how it works that I kind of lose sight of it.
Right. And it also doesn't help that a lot of these transactions require a lot of thought, trying to figure out where Eric Burns fits into this lineup. What does that mean? And how much money we have left? What kind of at-bats he's going to get? You know, every transition lately has been further murking waters of the left field, first base, DH versus lefties versus righties picture. And I think there's about 9 guys right now fitting into that 3-position platoon.
It's funny because when they signed Burns, I mean, Burns was an easy move to understand. Like, okay, they need a righty to get against lefties in left field. I thought they would get maybe somebody capable of playing the infield as that last guy, but I thought, whatever, no, this makes sense. He slides in, he'll platoon with your hands, whatever. That works. Then Darko fucking throws everything. I don't know.
Well, hopefully he works out better than the last designated left-handed masher we acquired from the Cleveland Indians. So
he's not going to be as good-looking, and he's not going to point.
Ben Broussard.
Oh, shit, the left-handed masher. That's right. Yeah. So Darko could easily fall down in Chicago. That would be interesting. GIF, everybody. I do have that GIF. It's in fast-forward. This is before I knew how to make it. That's just funny that way.
Well, at least he won't be not pinch hit for Raul Ibanez in a key situation.
I feel bad for anybody who's become a Mariners fan in the last couple of years because they have no idea what we're talking about.
That was 2006. Whatever.
That was a long time ago if you think
about
it.
That's true. So what does, aside from filling the obvious hole of a right-handed hitter and kind of ignoring the Ryan Gargo signing, what does Eric Burns bring to this team?
I will leave aside all of the tempting spunk, energy, hustle, grit jokes.
Tumbling ability.
I'm kind of dreading. I mean, I was so happy when we got rid of Willie Bloomquist, not only because we got rid of Willie Bloomquist, but because I could not stand one more grit and hustle joke. So, leaving that aside, Eric Burns, even in his two recent bad years, he still hit lefties. And it's really, you sign him because you think he has a chance to be healthy. If he's healthy, we know he can be useful because he can hit lefties. And if he's healthy, he can run. He was a good defender when he could run. He was a kind of a reasonable defender, it seems like, even when he couldn't run.
Yeah.
Somehow. He'll fill his role if he sticks. If he's not healthy, whatever. There's no commitment. We'll just get rid of him. It's not that hard to find a right-handed corner outfielder. But Burns has, I mean, Milton Bradley has more obvious upside, but Burns is kind of in the same boat, you know, where he's had a lull recently, but he has that track record where he has produced at a pretty high level before, and he's only 34. He seems like the type to stay in shape for a while, as long as he's not ripping his hamstrings off of his bone. I think I'm looking forward to it. He's not going to make a huge difference, but he's going to be, I think, if he's healthy, which I think he should be, even though he's injury prone, he'll be pretty good, and he's going to be really good blogging material, which is also a bigger deal for me than I guess it should be for anybody. But it is so much better to be able to write about people who are either interesting or incredibly boring. No more of this in-between stuff.
And I will say he does seem to fit this mold of player that Sorensen has acquired. The Ian Snell, the Jack Wilson, the Milton Bradley, the guy who is not an ace, but a legitimate borderline all-star type of 3 or 4 win player as recently as 2-3 seasons ago, and then has completely just had their value destroyed by either injury, starting to suck, mental fragility, whatever the hell is wrong with Ian Snell, which we'll get to later. So what about Ryan Gargo then? So we have Eric Burns to play the outfield, be our backup, possibly starting left field, relegating Langerhans to backup. Either way, he's our third and a half outfielder, if you will. Ryan Gargo obviously should never set foot really in the field at all.
That might be a little harsh. It's hard to get a read on his defensive numbers, but I don't see any reason to believe that he's a disaster.
At first base,
right. I mean, you don't want to see him anywhere else. And it's cool that he can be, I guess, an emergency catcher, but how often has the emergency catcher ever come up? And as much as they'll talk about it, you know, people talk about this every year. I think there was a big deal when Raul Ibanez was our emergency catcher a couple of years ago. It was like, oh, think of the flexibility he could add. But no, it doesn't work that way. So maybe Gargo catch a few innings. But realistically, he's here to be on the bench, and I think to platoon with Casey Kochman and pick up, you know, a sort of event elsewhere. What is interesting, obviously, the big story about signing Gargo is, You can go back and forth on what you think are the roster implications, whether you think it means Burns or Langerhans goes away, but I really do think this is a clear sign that the Mariners are leading towards an 11-man pitching staff. And Wakamatsu was talking on Mariners.com the other day where he hinted at that. He even said there, right now it's played out, it looks like they're set for an 11-man pitching staff. And we'll see how things go in spring training. After a winter of wanting them to go this way, it looks like they will, because I don't see a way that the roster works very well otherwise.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I have to say, after not just a winter of lobbying that, just years of railing against the 7-man bullpen, to have the team possibly on the verge of going to a 6-man bullpen almost scares me a little bit. I don't want to be proven wrong. I don't want it to blow up in my face. But I guess we'll see. You know, it's definitely worth trying.
Like, if you're the Mariners, you get Eric Burns, you get Milton Bradley, and you're able to get them for the price of Carlos Silva and the league minimum and a couple extra $1 million, because you understand they have been hurt. They have underachieved. They've been injured. You know that they're not dependable. That's why they're cheap. If they were dependable, they're good players. So the Mariners are well aware of the risks of having guys like Burns and Bradley on a roster. So you have to think it's an 11-man pitching staff, because otherwise the Mariners are putting themselves in real danger of having some ugly later innings if somebody gets hurt.
And I will say, so if we assume for now that it is 11-man pitching staff, I think there's 4. Felix, Lee, Roland Smith, Snell, Bardsma, Lowe, Kelly, and League that are guaranteed spots. Vargas, I have to imagine, makes the team either in the rotation or the bullpen at some point just because of the flotsam left. I think he's the best. And I don't know what the situation is with people like French, Olsen, obviously, I know Pfister and Hill can both still be sent down and brought back up. I think French can still be sent down. Olsen, I think, is out of options.
Whatever.
And Petit, or Yuppie, is clearly out of options. But they do have some flexibility in having sort of Seattle to Tacoma Bullpen Express. If, you know, and that's one of those things that gets brought up a lot as in opposition to the seven-man bullpen, or in opposition to getting rid of the seven-man bullpen, is that the team doesn't have enough dependable starters. You can wear them out with a tough game, but the back end of the bullpen is so fungible that if Lucas French starts your season as your 25th man, your 11th pitcher, and he has to go six innings in a mop-up role because Ian Snell just walked 27 guys, and you know you're not going to be able to use him for 4 days, you can send him back down to Tacoma and bring up somebody fresh.
Yeah, I mean, you don't even have to send him away, you know, you can just keep him in his hotel.
Right, I mean, figuratively, I mean, transactionally, you can send him away, but yeah, you can stay with the team. And you only lose him for, I think, 10 days is the required amount that somebody has to stay in AAA if they get sent down. I believe it's 10 days. So it's not really a big deal. So it'll be exciting to go through. But back specifically to Ryan Garko for a second, there's an interesting thing I think that didn't get brought up yet was that he's actually still club control.
Really?
Yes, he's only really gotten about 3 years of service time. So if the Mariners so choose, he's arbitration eligible through 2012.
Okay.
Which is another one of the just a little nifty thing about him, especially since he's going to be making peanuts relatively. This season, even if he does really well, and Mariners decide to keep him, his arbitration award in 2011 is probably not going to be that high. So he could potentially be a useful piece, not just this season.
Of course, going forward, he's only going to get paid more, obviously, than he is now. He's still under team control. And then you have to, unless he really breaks out, you have to wonder, does Ryan Garko contribute enough as presumably just a lefty masher to worth seven figures? Actually, yeah, he's getting, what, $500,000?
He's getting $550,000 guaranteed.
Yeah, with incentives that he'll never touch.
Right. Well, he'll probably touch a couple of them, but yeah, not.
Well, are there several of them, or is it just a flat 600 where he gets more than $1 million? I don't know. It's not that big of a deal. Regardless, going forward, he has a very limited role. Ryan Garko, and it is neat to have him under team club control, but I don't know if that's actually going to be a factor. I mean, for all we know, the team can go out and get a real first baseman during the season anyway. They seem to have a lot more hope for Kaufman, certainly, who's also under team control, correct? Or is he out? This is last year.
Boy, I think he has one more year, but I don't.
Well, I have this bookmark, so you keep talking, and I'm going to go ahead and do this thing.
And I think that's a point that you brought up is going to be important, is that in order for Wakamatsu to kind of manage this DH first base, left field, bench sort of mishmash of players, could be kind of difficult with some people like Milton Bradley, or if Eric Burns has kind of an ego about starting when healthy, Bradley has an ego about starting when healthy, or if he has an ego about doing whatever it is he does when he's whatever, as close as he gets to healthy, that could present a problem. If they're all humble enough to accept that, for better or worse, every person on that team that we've talked about in the last couple weeks, aside from maybe Milton Bradley, is a role player, we're not penciling any of them in to be a star, or to get a lion's share of starting playing time, they're willing to accept that. That does, there's so much flexibility, and the playing time breakdown at that point really, I think, is not a huge deal as far as keeping players happy.
It's funny, when you look at the potential playing time breakdowns, it's like you're counting on Milton Bradley to get injured or Eric Burns to get injured. That's why you don't give them full-time jobs, which is the right thing to do. But then it's almost like if they stay healthy, you're screwed, or somebody's screwed. It's almost the worst-case scenario, or second-worst-case scenario. And I do think Wakamatsu is a big challenge this year. I mean, Milton Bradley is obviously the big challenge
for
Wakamatsu, but Eric Burns, based on what I've heard, you know, he had a little bit of an ego thing in Arizona where he wanted to start all the time, and Bradley is going to want a lot of playing time, and Junior's going to shut up. Junior is just happy to be on the bench. I don't think we have to worry at all about his role. He'll get his at-bats. The public is going to demand that he gets his at-bats.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a delicate situation, but I suppose worst comes to worse, you know, if Eric Burns starts making a big stink, just get rid of him. If it really gets there. But I think that's unlikely. And certainly if the team is playing well, people are going to shut up. This kind of touches on the chemistry argument, which we don't have to get into now, because that would be another 3 hours or 2 minutes since we would agree on everything.
Right. That's an excellent point.
It's going to be the challenge, but if the team is playing well, it shouldn't be a problem. And if the team isn't playing well, then it should be easy to make some moves to address that problem.
Right. That's a good point. Just that we don't, you know, if Milton Bradley pulls a Milton Bradley, we're not on the hook for him really anymore. You know, we got rid of our attitude problem with Carlos Silva. We got Eric Burns for the minimum. If they act up, there's not even a sunk cost with them anymore, psychologically.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, bye. And I think it's great that we are planning for these injuries, and we're planning for them at the major league level, with major league talent, because is there a hitter in Tacoma, aside from presumably Michael Saunders, that is at all interesting? I mean, what's your next best there? Mike Karp?
Probably.
Yasusubo?
Maybe Tui. Tui would be the most likely to come up and fill some sort of role for a couple of weeks, probably.
Yeah,
but Bradley, we can't predict Milton Bradley, obviously. That's the big question. But I feel like if Bradley's playing well, he's probably not going to be a problem. Because if Bradley's playing well, the team's in a good position, Bradley's feeling good, getting him at bats, he won't have anything to complain about. So you would think if Bradley's playing well, that should minimize the risk. And if he's not playing well, then it becomes really easy to say, like, okay, well, you can go be the waiver wires problem because we don't want you anymore. So it's really not the what would be bad is if Bradley is playing well and he is still pissed off about something. But now we're just arguing hypotheticals where we just paint Milton Bradley as a crazy person who's unpredictable, and that's not fair to Milton Bradley. There is a method to that madness somewhere, and I think he is among the riskier players in baseball, but I think people have overblown it. He's not just a guarantee to blow up. Crazy people. He's not clinically insane.
As far as we know.
As far as we know. He could be, but we have David Arzma with the bullpen hug and all that shit going on. We have lots of insane people on the scene. Have you ever heard Mark Lowe talk?
That's true. Well, Seattle does drive people a little.
Yeah. Bradley, maybe it's just because the transaction happened so long ago. I'm just not that concerned about him because whatever happens, he'll either be a success or he'll fail and we'll ditch him and that's it. Because the Carlos Silva chapter is over and at least this time we're taking a risk with upside.
I will say the nice thing about this whole Eric Burns, Ryan Garcia, that combined, at least guaranteed, they're getting paid less than $1 million. Mm-hmm. And even if Garco maxes out on his incentives, we're looking at $1.5 million total between the two, which I think is still less than the Mets are paying Bobby Bonilla this year. So,
long brand that up. What is it? Through like 2025?
I believe it's through 2025. It starts this year, I think.
Bonilla's got so many bitches right now in his hot tub. Living the life of that old fat guy. People talk about the best job in baseball. I remember I was reading a Sports Illustrated article like 7 years ago or something about how Todd Pratt had the best job in baseball because he was a backup catcher or something. No, Bobby Bonilla has the best job in baseball.
Yeah, it's hard to beat that.
Yeah.
So speaking of transactions that happened so long ago that we seem to have forgotten them.
The Mariners got Darren Bragg and unloaded into Boston in a curious move. I was going, anyway, moving on. Ian Snell, is that where we're going to put it?
No, I was going to bring up and tie it in with the talk today about catchers, but.
Oh, right.
Remember when Keiji Jojima just up and left?
Yeah. Remember how that was kind of cool and now we still like it, but still wish he were here for less money?
Yeah. That's something that I think. It's weird because the moves that have come afterwards, the Cliff Lee, the Sean Figgins, et cetera, and how early in the season it was that Jojima left, it really is easy to kind of not think of that as part of our offseason anymore. But Jojima leaving really enabled us to sign like Sean Figgins or trade for Cliff Lee. It opened up that payroll room, which it seems currently was necessary since it looks like we don't have much more left.
Mm-hmm.
So, as much as it was kind of great that Jojima left, it was, to be more accurate, it was great that Jojima's salary left.
Yeah.
Boy, do I really wish Kenji Jojima was still here.
You know what's interesting, if you think about it, is so Kenji pretty much left of his own volition. I think the team probably left it up to him, even though they obviously had a preference. Cliff Lee basically happened out of thin air, because Ruben Amaro called Jack and said, hey, you want Cliff Lee? Milton Bradley, what I'm getting at is that as much as this has been kind of a miracle offseason, and the front office has done a great job of navigating the winter seas, I do think there was a lot of luck involved, which you can't forget. Or maybe not luck, but things that weren't directly in their control. I mean, if Kenji doesn't leave, this offseason could be completely different. Yes. You can't, Jack traded for Cliff Lee, but Jack didn't initiate it. You know, he didn't seek out Cliff Lee. He kind of fell into his lap. I don't know if we have Sean Figgins, if we still have Jojima. Ryan Garko, there was no demand. Eric Burns just got cut. So there were a lot of factors in there.
Just a lot of good timing.
This is a situation where I think it's really important to remember that you should judge your front office based on its philosophies and how it goes about building a roster rather than how it actually builds a roster and the players it brings in, because transactions, you don't know how they happen. Cliff Lee fell into the Mariners' lap, like I said. You don't know the backstory. You don't know how much of it was your front office. You don't know if they maybe got lucky with that move. What you want to examine is that the same old pulled Di Podesta chart that everybody posts, where it's like bad process, bad outcome, all that stuff. You really want to examine the processes, and that's how you evaluate a front office. Because if Jason Kendall works out for the Royals, it doesn't mean he was a good move. You know, a theory behind that acquisition was bad. The theory behind what the Mariners have done this offseason has, by and large, been good. And that is more important when it comes to examining this team than the players they actually got.
And it's more important for sustaining their success, or in Bavese's case, failure.
Definitely.
Comes our way. So, but sticking with the catching, so obviously we don't have Jojima, but we do have Rob Johnson, the newly apparently healed and bouncing back to what, I'm not exactly sure, Rob Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
Adam Moore and Josh Bard. I'm going to go ahead and exclude the guy I can't even remember who we signed.
Eliezer Alfonso, owner of the worst projected walk rate in baseball.
Oh, well, wow. We signed him. Wow, really?
You didn't see my fun fact like a week ago?
It was only a week ago. Are you sure it wasn't like...
No, this is a week ago. I was playing with the Sean projection, so I'll just recite it on air for anybody who missed it. Sean projected something like 1,300 or 1,400 players for next season, you know, major leagues, minor leagues. And I took all of those projections and I looked at projected walk rate. Second worst in baseball was Greg Holman, and he beat Eliezer Alfonso, who is a major league veteran.
Yes, I remember this now. Yeah.
Yeah, that is incredible to me. There's not even like Brian Bocock is projected for a better walk rate.
What else does Brian Bocock have? Trying to draw walks.
That face. God, true. You could have a Bocock Fahey middle infield and it would just melt my heart. I would get minor league season tickets.
Reggie Willits in center field?
Dude, okay, if we can't interview our own minor leaguers because they all leave or die or whatever, we interview Brian Bocock and Brandon Fahey. We find out where they are. If they come to Portland, I'll take care of it.
Deal.
Hey, Brandon, like, you want to go out for drinks or soda?
A grape knee high.
I'm laughing because I don't know what that is.
It's a 1950s joke. That's right. I went there.
Wow. Okay. Brandon Fahey is a puppy. I think edited that out. Forget it. I don't know where I'm going with that.
So anyways, we have the three. We have Johnson, Moore, and Bard. Obviously, we can't read anything into this front office or walk them off to see what's going to happen, but gut feeling, or maybe gut feeling versus what you would prefer to see, what do you think is going to happen between? We're not going to carry all three, obviously, especially now with Ryan Garko filling that possible third emergency catcher role, which also means Jamie Burke's not coming back again this year.
Yeah, no, he's with the Nationals.
Yeah. Good for him.
Even Miguel Batista.
That will not stop being funny.
They see him as a starter. Anyway, sorry. Staying on topic, the Nationals are funny.
Right. Mm-hmm. And amazingly, the Royals didn't sign that other catcher. But so, okay, yes, for the fourth time.
I feel like. I know where you're going Johnson with this. Moore, I'll just go ahead and butt in.
Yeah, do that.
I posted this on Twitter a while ago. My gut feeling is that we see a lot of Josh Bard, but I want to make clear this is not based on any inside information or anything I've heard from the coaching staff. The organization loves Adam Moore. They love him kind of like they do Rob Johnson, but I just see it. If the Mariners aren't going to give me any information, I have to look at it like how most organizations, the average organization, would do it. And the average organization probably wouldn't be real keen on going into the season with a guy who's as young as Rob Johnson and who had a 12 dozen more surgeries than Hadi Montag.
Whoa!
And a rookie in Adam Moore. They could. I know that they love Johnson for his you know, he plays like a veteran, and they love Adam Moore because he plays like a veteran. But Josh Bard is a veteran. If Adam Moore came up, he'd be splitting time. They probably want Moore to get more time than that. So I do think we see Josh Bard, and I don't think that's a problem, because realistically, I think Josh Bard is actually pretty good for a catcher, certainly for a backup. Adam Moore, we can't count him to do that much this year anyway. In terms of win value, the difference between Josh Bard and Adam Moore may as well be negligible, but if anything, it's probably a boost in Bard's favor.
Yeah, and I might even go as far to say that would extend between Bard and Johnson, too. I don't really think there's any combination of these three catchers that would really produce even maybe a league average catcher out of this. I don't see us getting two wins out of the catcher position.
Right.
No matter what happens, unless, and I don't know, I just don't see a lot of high potential in Rob Johnson's bat or Adam Moore's bat for this year.
And one of the reasons there's not that many people talking about this little catcher situation right now is that it doesn't really make that much of a difference, or if it does, we don't know how to measure that difference. I mean, we saw how difficult it would be just to measure framing, let alone actually pitch calling and stuff. So it's one of those things where we don't know. We can just say Josh Bard's okay, Rob Johnson is allegedly okay, and Adam Moore is a kid with talent, but probably less talent than people think he has overall, because, you know, he's not some elite-level catching prospect as much as we would like him to be. So it's kind of one of those things. We just have to leave up to the coaching staff, and they'll decide who they think receives the pitching staff the best, and then it'll be fine, and we'll get by, and we'll probably see a lot of Adam Moore sometime this year anyway. I'm looking forward to Bard, because I like my team to be good and interesting, and Josh Bard is a very interesting person to watch. I quite enjoy his temper. For anybody out there who's concerned, I don't think he's like a clubhouse problem. He's just,
just very angry.
Very angry. You know, Walk was all about nobody getting ejected last year, but when Ichiro got ejected, I fucking loved it.
Yes.
I love ejections. Everybody loves ejections. Everybody knows this, they're pointless or even a negative. Like, you know, when your manager gets tossed, your player gets tossed, it's stupid, but you love it. It's like the fights in hockey. It doesn't make that much of a difference, but it's entertaining.
Yeah, it's... I forgot the point I was...
Cool.
Oh, putting Josh Bard and... We made this comment when he was signed, but putting Josh Bard and Milton Bradley on the same team would be quite interesting. Now you throw in the Eric Burns, and this team is just oodling over with personality. I don't know what personality.
And don't forget the bullpen.
And the bullpen, but there's just a lot of it.
Yeah. Ryan Langerhans is the most boring player on this team, I think, and he still shoots animals for fun.
Well, although they all shoot animals.
Yeah, all of our white players shoot animals for fun. That could be racial, so I'm going to go there. It's, you know, if Ryan Langerhans might be the most boring player on your team, that's cool, because we all just have this irrational love for Ryan Langerhans anyway. So it's going to be, there's no more Batista on the team.
Yeah, no, it's great for us, just writing material.
Yeah.
You know, and it makes the team more fun to watch and fun to sit through every day.
Yeah.
So that's great. Yeah.
Even Garrett Olsen is interesting, just because he looks so weird and out of place.
I want him to be better. I want him to be good. He looks like he should be good.
No, he looks like he should be an actor.
Well, I don't mean physically looks like he should be good. I mean his old numbers.
His old numbers were good. And that's why I've asked people, it's like, did he used to throw him in four? What happened to Garrett Olsen? How did this stuff, what we saw last year, work ever in any level?
But you're right, he looks... He looks like an actor trying to portray a pitcher.
Yeah.
It's like somebody's trying to play Garrett Olsen.
You know how in any, not any baseball movie, but in most baseball movies where baseball isn't the key plot ingredient, you'll see, you know, they'll have pitchers and batters, and they'll have little baseball scenes, but the motions are hilariously bad. Like Freddie Prinze Jr. didn't know how to pitch, you know, so.
Tim Robbins,
all of them. You know, you can tell, you get a vague idea, oh, they must be playing baseball, but this doesn't look right at all. So, you know, Garrett Olsen looks like an actor who's committed to learning the role, but is still an actor. It's like when, who's that country? See, Garth Brooks worked out with the Padres in spring training. Mm-hmm. You know, Garth Brooks can swing a bat. He knows how to hit the baseball on the field, but at the end of the day, it's Garth Brooks playing with Major League Baseball players, and it's just like, okay, Garth, games now, go away.
Although, to be fair, the Padres might have some useful friends this year.
No, he's far too interesting to make that team. I had a friend who ran into Adrian Gonzalez in a store. Just, I forgot what store it was. It's not important. He was just there with his wife buying like leg magic, whatever that workout instrument is. I don't, there's a bunch of them. You're just there. And my friend was like, hey, Adrian, blah, blah, blah. My little brother is your biggest fan. And it's just like Adrian Gonzalez is like, okay, you can take a picture with me. It was just really tight and, you know, accommodating, but not interesting. It's not like she ran into Dustin Pedroia and Pedroia's like, let's go do lines of the hooker nest. Or whatever it is Dustin Pedroia does, I guess, shoot bunnies with bunnies. Cannon. I've lost my point now, but basically the only interesting player on the Padres left is Kyle Blanks, because he's comically huge and beat the crap out of the ball and scored an inside the park home run last year, even though it was 470 pounds. But that's it. Yeah. You know, they have John Garland on that team. They don't have Peavy anymore. They have whatever's left of Chris Young, but Chris Young, whenever he pitches, just like he's a giant who's falling asleep and about to fall down when he throws the ball. It's just, I can't believe. I'm so glad I'm leaving the city. But then I'm going to Portland where I get their AAA affiliate. So I get the Padres who aren't good enough to make the Padres.
Oh, that was a good rant.
Man, that organization, the Royals are hopeless right now, but they're hopeless with, it's fun. Not the right word. Sorry, Royals fans. It's not fun. But there's emotion there. They have Granky in there like, why do you keep making bad moves? But the Padres are just like, okay, so if we can't win, the sports teams are there to win and be entertaining. The Padres can't win, and they've decided, well, if we can't win, we shouldn't probably even bother trying to be entertaining. We shouldn't disrupt the city. You know, they should go about their own business. We'll just play the season, whatever. It's basically the front office won't even watch. It'll be their version of simulating a diamond mine season where they're just like, okay, let's put a roster together, let them do whatever, and then we'll pick it up next year. We'll see who's free agent. It's just so bad. Why would anybody watch that team?
I don't know. So, thinking about how bad the Padres are going to be and kind of moving in, Pakoda finally came out with their team forecasts, and then they came out with them again, and then came out with them again.
Yeah.
And I eagerly await their fourth iteration, which will still be hopeless at that. But I don't know what they're currently at, but their first one had the Mariners at 86 wins.
Mm-hmm.
Which seemed reasonable. Then they dropped us down to 77 wins, and I don't know what they have us at now, but
I'm pretty sure we're in last.
Either way, my beef was more with the second iteration, because it has at 77 wins, which just seems insane, but I don't want to tempt Scrappy.
Okay, still 77. There, we're now 10 behind the Rangers.
Okay, and does it still have us at 752 runs allowed?
Sure does.
And the Rangers at 760?
Sure does.
So, okay. So I do have up-to-date figures. Just pause here. It has us allowing only 8 fewer runs than the Rangers did last year. Or than the Rangers
this year.
For this year. That's insane. First of all, the Rangers' pitching is not better than ours. Just in a vacuum, our pitching is better than the Rangers' pitching. Mm-hmm. Secondly, we play in Seattle, and they play in Texas. And thirdly, our defense is going to be probably better than theirs, although that's the weakest of my points because Texas has a very good defense. But
so here's last year we allowed 40. Actually, this gap is smaller than I thought. We allowed 48 fewer than Texas, but 48 isn't 8, and we got Cliff Lee and Brandon Lee. And I mean, Texas's pitching is better
and improved our defense
or at least kept it amazing, you know, because you would expect a regression from our level last year. But I think we made enough moves that it should still be awesome. So
you really only expect some regression from Gutierrez, obviously. But I mean, we were placed. We should get so much better at shortstop.
Mm-hmm.
We'll get better at first base.
You know. Hey, we don't have to go position by position. I don't know. Did you have anything else you wanted to say about this, or?
Well, just the Dodgers being at 83 wins just seemed insane again as well.
And the Nationals are at 76. Their first iteration had the Nationals at 500. The Nationals.
Yeah, I think I had them at 82, actually, in their first iteration.
Man.
So.
There's the Padres with a very boring 71.
But I will say, so, obviously, nobody put a lot of faith into those. Mm-hmm. Even Baseball Prospectus immediately came out and said, okay, these are long.
Long.
It's a lot of long.
You know, it is, what's interesting, not that you can take these things too seriously, but the only three teams projected above 88 wins, sorry, the Yankees, Red Sox, and Rays. So even though these projections are probably wrong or not very accurate, they did still nail. Those are the three best teams in baseball, and that must suck for Tampa Bay.
Yeah, it probably sucks more for the Orioles and the Blue Jays.
Yeah, well, so
that's
they don't
nothing
have fans.
New. At least the Rays had hope for a little bit.
Yeah.
But what I think, do you have a Baseball Prospectus subscription?
No, I haven't had one for 3 years.
Okay. So what I think, first of all, the obvious factor, the biggest factor is Pecota does not know how to deal with defense, which makes projecting a team like Seattle or the Rangers or the A's really kind of troublesome. It's probably fine with the Angels because, you know. But second of all, I do wonder, you know, if Felix just had that breakthrough season, Pecota might look a couple of years back. And certainly with Cliff Lee, I wonder if 3 years ago was having an impact on Cliff Lee's projection now, which isn't entirely unfair, but I think we have enough evidence to say that Cliff Lee is a completely different pitcher now.
Right. I would agree with that. But I'd even say, as a contrary to the first point, it's not like we're projecting him to be a 6.5 win pitcher.
Mm-hmm.
We're already knocking him down from to 5 wins, I think, is what I currently have. Maybe 5.5, but he's been over 7 the last 2 years. We're already factoring in some regression, and we're already factoring in some caution from his previous years as well. I just logically, I see no basis for rating the Mariners that low. But on the other hand, this is a weird situation for me to be in because I can't remember the last time that I really trumpeted the Mariners as being better than everybody else is assuming. With the amount of hype that we're getting from everybody because of how active and how awesome our offseason is, and we're kind of becoming the bandwagon.
Oh my God, we are. We are the darlings of this offseason.
It's weird because then we're already getting the bandwagon backlash from a lot of people, especially very vocal Angels fans.
Yeah.
And it's weird to be in that situation where, no, I don't want us to be a bandwagon, but on the other hand, no, our offseason was really good, and we are probably a really good team, but I don't want us to be, you know, don't take it to me and I'm saying we're going to win the division because then you're going to throw it in my face when we don't. And it's like, no, I don't know.
So I guess two things. First of all, I guess we'll have to put up a post sometime before the season starts that says another post where we explain, yeah, the Mariners are pretty good, but it's a tight division and I don't think we're the favorites. So don't think that we're leading this cause. There's people who have taken it and run and they think Felix and Lee are just going to lead us to the promised land. That's going too far, I think. And you do have to wonder about the depth charts that Pecota's using, because I don't have a subscription, I can't look at it. They could have that all wrong. The Mariners are hard enough to figure out for us, let alone for Baseball Prospectus. And I guess you also have to think, they probably think Ardna sucks, and League isn't what he was last year, according to these projections. So whether that's right or wrong, there's a couple people in there. But then I guess every team probably has a couple of those.
Yeah, I think when it comes down to it, it's just one of those things where I think it's you're always better off if you have intelligent fans of the team. They're always going to be more informed than anybody who tries to take interest in every team.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, just as it is with prospects, where if I have a prospect question on the Mariners, I don't go to Jim Callis.
Mm-hmm.
I don't go to John Sickles. I go to Jay. I go to Mark. I go to Connor. You know, one of those people. I think it's the same sort of thing with this division.
Yeah.
So.
And what's tricky is not every team has those kinds of followers, you know. We are not to toot our own horn, but the Mariners definitely have one of the best bloggers in baseball, and credit to USS Mariner for basically building it. You know, they're the ones leading the way, and there's just not many teams that have that. And I guess I was going to rip on the Angels, but they do have Sean Smith.
Yeah, but I don't know how much blogging he does on the Angels specifically.
No, but I would think that he would have pretty good insight. I would trust him more than I would trust Baseball Prospectus, although he would probably just pair his own projections. Maybe. Sorry. Maybe not.
No offense, Sean.
If you're listening.
But I will say, I was also kind of relieved to see that the replacement level Yankee blog came out with their first iteration of their Diamond Mine projections, which I always thought were pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And they have us at 87 wins. They also have the Dodgers at 87 wins, so it kind of passes that smell test, too. And it's got us kind of this general run profile that I thought we should expect. It has our run prevention staying about the same, and it has our offense getting a lot better. That combination you and Graham talked about, just the regression from, yes, we were bad last year, but we also suffered from a lot of bad luck.
Mm-hmm.
And we lost about 40 or 50 runs that we should have scored based on our offense through hitting like crap with runners in scoring position and just some other fluky things. And we've also legitimately gotten a little bit better offense, and the Diamond Mine projections seem to indicate that it's got us scoring 100 more runs than we did last year.
I'm trying to find that post. I'm having trouble with the...
It's under the fan shots, but the nice thing about that, so I liked the projections, how they looked at a couple of the teams that I highlighted,
mm-hmm.
but the other teams in the division, really didn't like. It had us winning the division, and it had us winning the division pretty handily.
Well, check this out. Sorry to cut you off. Pakoda says Mariners 8 runs better than the Rangers on defense. This post, I think this is the one you're talking about. Diamondmind using the Cairo projections. Is that sound right?
Yes.
This has us as being 151 runs better than the Rangers in run prevention.
Well, that's probably too much, too. That's probably a little too far to the other extreme. And
wow.
And that will give you sort of an example of just the level of disagreement so far with these.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's early, but boy, that's cause for concern's not the right word, but skepticism.
Yeah. This is kind of touching on something you said before, but just so people get some numbers, in case you don't realize, when we talk about how the Mariners' offense, we would expect to just regress up anyway, even if they kept the same bodies. One season is a big sample size, but it can be misleading. If you look at the American League overall, and this is true here, teams will hit better with men on base than they will with the bases empty. I think this is fairly well known, even though it's not exactly household knowledge. Now, if you look at the Mariners last year, they hit .261 with the bases empty, with a .406 slugging percentage. Now, if you look at them with the runners in scoring position, that drops to a .234 batting average and a .358 slugging, which is just completely unsustainable. Their OPS was 65 points worse than second worst with the runners in scoring position. And that's not that systematic thing, you know. There's nothing the Mariners are doing that makes them worse with the runners in scoring position, sustainably so. So that's just one of those things where it makes a huge difference. Think about all those hits they didn't get with the runners in scoring position that they, I deserved isn't the right word, but that they would have gotten over a bigger sample size. That makes a huge difference. So the offense is not as bad as it looked last year. And that's something a lot of people need to remember.
Right. And in this case, normally we ignore context, but this is a context specific thing. Mm-hmm. Every one of those robbed or hits that didn't fall in would have likely scored a run, directly scored a run, which would impact the bottom line run scored for the team. So I don't know. It is something where I'm getting kind of tired of people parroting our 2009 Pythagorean record. Whenever anybody talks about the Mariners being involved in the 2010 race, it's, you know, really, we get it. We're the ones who, you know, welcome to us in 2007. We were making those arguments. And for one thing, we've moved a little bit beyond that. We have better run estimators. We have better ways of projecting now. But it's also really of all the fan bases to talk about. You don't need to tell us. We're the ones who were telling you all throughout 07. And all throughout the offseason that no, you really shouldn't be paying attention to the Mariners. Stop talking about us winning the West. We're really bad.
So this might be rough, but I'm on average using the American League average. Every hit with a runner in scoring position drove in 1.4 runs. Okay, so if we just hit the same with runners in scoring position as we did with bases empty, we would have had 34 more hits. And if you multiply that by the 1.4, you're talking about 50 runs.
Yeah.
What did we score last year? We scored 640. All of a sudden, we're up at 690. 640 is embarrassingly bad.
I had not realized that it was that low.
Yeah, well, I didn't either until I just looked. But now, all of a sudden, just with contact regression, we're looking at almost 700 runs scored. And I guess you wouldn't regress all the way up to .261. You would be in the middle, I guess, because hitting with runners in scoring position was our team also. But regardless, you're talking about an enormous difference that just disappears in the splits that people don't pay attention to.
It'd be good to see, hopefully this year, them not repeat that.
Yeah.
I, for one, am getting tired of talking about the hypothetical. I really, really, really want baseball to start.
Yeah, goddamn, this daily blogging schedule is sometimes there's times when I think, man, I wish the offseason would never end because I kind of hate being on a schedule to write, you know? Like, it's nice to be able to go to bed before 1 or 2 in the morning sometimes. But on the other hand, it's like, man, what are we talking about now? It's like, is this an 11-man pitching staff or a 12? That's a big question, but we're going to talk about it more. You better believe it. We have another 3 months or 2 months.
Do you think Ryan Garko is going to get 300 plate appearances or 350? And what do those 50 plate appearances mean? Oh, boy. Yeah.
We're going to talk about things that make a difference of like half a run. It's fun, but man, I just start. And then we have to go through the fucking spring training meat grinder. God.
Yes. Yeah. It starts earlier every year, though. We're already hearing the fluff pieces come out. So.
Mike Wilson hit 6 home runs. Is he going to break camp with the team? I don't know. What do you think?
No. Moving on. Actually, that might be one thing that we don't face so much this year, just because we have that glut of every possible bench fill role player already signed to a major league contract. Is that I don't care how good Mike Morse hits in spring training. I don't care how good Matt Tuiasosopo looks. He's not making the team. We don't have room for him. There's just literally no way he can make the team.
There's still going to be fans that want us to just get rid of Langerhans, you know, or Burns, I guess, because there's no loyalty there. But I guarantee you, Mariner fans probably like Burns more than they like Langerhans already, just because, on average, not to look at Lanning Road.
Well, that's stupid. Ryan Langerhans hit 2 walk-off home runs for us. So.
Yeah, that was amazing. He hit twice as many as Griffey did. Or did Griffey?
Not a home run, no.
All right, well then, fucking worthless.
I don't think he even had a walk-off hit.
He just had that long fly on the 8th that we thought was a home run.
Oh, that would have been so great.
It's the Giants. That might have been the Randy Johnson game.
It was.
Cool.
And it would have also been great because then it would have ended the game earlier instead of going into extra innings.
Extra innings are the worst.
They are. They're just awful.
Okay, maybe that's a topic for another time. Do we have much? We're starting to get there, but is there anything else that you wanted to talk about today? I guess we never did talk about Ian Snell, did we?
No, we didn't.
I guess we could cover Ian. We might as well just close on Ian Snell, because neither of us really has a lot of in-depth information on Ian Snell. He's a big question mark. He's a question mark who's pretty much guaranteed a role and a pretty good opportunity, even if he doesn't stick all year. So I don't think you have anything to say on Snell, right?
No, I read the, I think it was what, in Slate, that article was published about his mental kind of breakdown in Pittsburgh and subsequent trading here and his fastball, one of the keys to his demise being over-reliance on fastballs the last couple of years. And I thought it was interesting. It might be the cause, but it's one of those things I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know if we're talking about the same article. I think yours might be different, but there was a Baseball Daily Digest article that was talking about, this one made the rounds, I think, of the Mariner blogosphere, talking about Snell's perceived velocity. You remember that?
Yes, I do.
And if you didn't read the article, the basic point was that Ian Snell apparently releases the ball further from the plate than the average pitcher, and he also tends to throw his fastball on the outside half of the plate, and both of those don't have an effect on pitch velocity, but they do have an effect on perceived velocity, or how fast the ball seems to the hitter. And obviously, that's far more important than the actual velocity. It's the reason Chris Young was able to succeed for that season, I guess. You know, Chris Young throws an 87-mile-per-hour piece of shit fastball, but he releases it like 20 feet from the plate, so it's almost impossible to catch up with. And this article was talking about how Snell needs to, I guess, work more inside to get his perceived velocity back up.
Right, because he's not going to suddenly start learning how to extend his pitching mechanics in order to release the ball 2 feet closer to the plate than he currently does. But he does, if he starts throwing his fastballs inside more, it will speed up the pitch to hitters. And it also probably, I think this is the article that the point that the other article made was that it would play better off of his slider as well.
Yeah.
With his fastball currently sitting on the outside corner and his slider moving in kind of the same general area, that right-handed hitters don't have to give a crap at all about the inner half of the plate, and the left-handed hitters get to see the motion of the pitch coming into their wheelhouse. So he's got kind of screwed on both sides, and that kind of explains why he sucks.
The big question, and the place where I stumble the most, is we have all these theories. We have his perceived velocity. We have his pitch effects data. But Ian Snell is not some guy who's never succeeded. You know, he had a good year in 2006, and he had a good year in 2007. Mm-hmm. And we don't know. Unless his mechanics have changed, his perceived velocity might have been just as big of an issue back then, and he made it work. So we don't have the kind of information that we need to arrive at a definitive conclusion, because Ian Snell in 2007 posted an FIP of 4, which, granted, National League, but that's good. You know, his strikeouts were high. He had walked some, but it wasn't a big problem. He was a good pitcher. Ian Snell succeeded, and what we have to assume that Ian Snell succeeded doing, by and large, what he did when he turned bad. He throws his fastball more than he did in 2007, but he throws his fastball the same as he did in 2006. He throws the breaking ball about as much. His pitches, his variety hasn't changed. His velocity hasn't changed. So it's really, if you want to make a mechanical argument, the key to solving Ian Snell, unless it's just mental damage, it could be, is that you're going to have to go into the tape and watch what he looked like back when he was good, and not just on one or two pitches, because maybe it was a consistency thing. Maybe his mechanics were more consistent then, maybe they're not now. I know we paid a lot of attention to that front toe or front foot angle. He came over, and I know the pitching coach Adair is aware of that, and they're looking at that. And actually, if you try a fake pitching motion in your room and kind of have an angle in your lead foot instead of pointing at home plate, it can make you release the ball further from home plate. And it's tempting to draw that convention.
Go ahead.
It has that effect, but as tempting as it is to draw a direct line and say, Ains Snell needs to figure out that front foot and that'll be fine, you have to figure out if he was throwing the same way in 06 and 07, because if he was, that's not the problem.
I think that's the key, and that's something that I didn't see in either of the two articles, I believe, is a real solid compare contrast from when Ains Snell was good to last year. What has changed? It was just the talk. There was some talk in the article I read about his fastball percentage going up from 2007, but then it just kind of devolved into talking about where he throws his fastball now and why that decreases his perceived velocity. But, you know, if he has been always throwing his fastball to the other half, outer half of the plate, well, he made it work somehow. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, as you said, some words, we have to figure out what changed, because we don't need to make Ains Snell better. We just need to make Ains Snell like old Ains Snell.
Yeah. That is the absolute key. And do you think Baseball Info, pitch effects, there wasn't good data, not a lot of data for 07, and obviously none in 06, but does Baseball Info Solutions have similar data? They have zone data.
They do have, it's been a while since I've looked at BIS data. I don't know. I do actually, though, I believe have 2006 BIS data. Mm-hmm. So I will, it's a good point, I will take a look at it and see what I can find from 2006 BIS and what limited 2007 pitch effects I have, and compare it to 2009, see if anything shows up.
And really, I mean, it would be awesome if we could do something with this, but more importantly is the team would have any information that's out there on Ains Snell in 06 and 07, any decent information is already available to the team, staying in possession of it. From the way they were talking about Snell, it seemed like they are concentrating on his mechanics. Because I think he seems like he's in a good place, whatever that means. I mean, as much as we would like to, there's no way we can ever analyze any professional athlete and his psychological status. For God's sake, I don't know what's going on with 95% of my friends, the people I talk to all the time. So there's no way we can look at Ains Snell, read his quotes in the newspaper, and think he's happier. I would think he has to be happier on account of this is in Pittsburgh. And the funny thing is, if you've ever spent time in Pittsburgh, you've never felt happier than when you're not there anymore. So that's going to work to his benefit. And it's a wonderful clubhouse. It's a supportive environment. But it's really easy to say Ains Snell came apart because of psychological issues, and I'm sure that played a part of it. But
they could be just he came apart because of something, and then once he started falling apart, the mental issues surfaced. It's the whole correlation and causation sort of thing. And he's been a head case, but did one cause the other? It's tough to tell.
Like applying the chemistry argument to an individual. Like, well, if he's happy, he's not going to play better, but if he sucks and then he gets down on himself, it could be a spiral.
Yeah. It's easy to sit here in armchair, that sort of stuff, but in terms of actually coming up with a theory, it's pretty weak.
So Ains Snell is a big wild card, and I believe in him to some extent, maybe less than I did when he traded for him just because he didn't do anything after coming over. He pretty much sucked.
He walked a lot of guys.
He walked a lot of guys, and we saw him walk a lot of guys in person.
Yeah.
He's going to be a wild card. It would just be really nice to push him back in the rotation one more spot, and I guess that's something we'll talk about next time. And maybe they'll have a new pitcher by next time.
They probably will. And we'll probably be underwhelmed by it. Either slightly underwhelmed or ecstatic.
Yeah.
Seems to be the only two types of moves.
I mean, they talked about adding that right-handed bat, like BH first base, and we're like, whoa, Jeff Kingston is being really candid. And then it turns out, oh, well, Ryan Gawker, already signed.
Yeah.
So the way they're talking about this pitcher, like Kingston, I think, said we intend to have a pitcher by next week, right? Weren't those his words?
I don't know. I wouldn't be... I don't know.
That is just... You know what, though? If it's Washburn, I guess we don't have anything to talk about.
Oh, we'll find something.
Until next time.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, we should wrap it up here.
Yes. All right. So thanks, everyone.